The What Shapes Us podcast is brought to you by Hume, H-U-M-E, Hume, supernatural. It's for you, it's for me, it's for everybody. And it's an all-natural deodorant with no metals, no junk that you put inside of your armpits and feel amazing. Full disclosure, I am a partner in Hume, but it took the collective of the powers that be to say, yes, we will ride with you on the What Shapes Us podcast. So thank you to Hume Supernatural. To learn more, go to humesupernatural.com or follow Hume Supernatural on the Instagram. As my Australian friends like to say, get it in your pits, mate. Hi, my name is Salema Mabena Masakela. I'll say it for you one more time. Salema Mabena Masakela. And you are listening to the What Shapes Us podcast. Episode number 2, my excitement levels, they are high. My excitement levels are so very high. So thank you for showing up. For those of you listening for the first time, go back and listen to episode 1 when you get some time. And then tell a friend to tell a friend. And of course, subscribe. First episode with Adam J. Foss, former district attorney from Boston, was incredibly well received. And I say that only because of the notes that we received here at the What Shapes Us podcast from all around the world via the Twitter, via the Instagram, via the emails. Lots of loving and kind things to say, which I can't tell you what that means to my soul because I was mad nervous. This being my first foray into the podcast space where I'm not a guest, but I am serving you from my own home, literally. And I'm happy to have you with us. So thank you for all of the incredible notes. The overwhelming theme was people saying that they felt like they learned something by listening to that conversation with Adam J. Foss about the role that district attorneys and prosecutors play in our justice system, especially at this time. So thank y'all. Thank y'all for listening. And for sending kindnesses. And listen, if you there's things you want to hear or you don't agree with or any way that you are constructively critical about the show in the interest of wanting it to get better, please, by all means, throw it our way. Any hate that you might have, save it for yourself or maybe talk to, you know, with your friends and family. But please, if you can, keep our inboxes clear of that shit. We'll take critiques and we'll take critical, but we won't take past there. But why am I speaking about these things? That's not why you're here. If you're here, it's because you're here for some more, which excites my soul. Excites my soul in a wild, wild, wild ass world. I don't know about y'all, but when I look back in the rearview mirror to 4.5 months ago here in these United States, when our dance with the devil that is the COVID began, I don't think any of us could have pictured. 4 months and change later, we are living in a new normal. Is it a temporary new normal? We shall see. But whatever it was and however it was we were living prior to mid-March seems like an old movie in my mind. Like when you look at old pictures or film before they got color, you know, color TV and color films. And it just seems like, wow, that was such a long time ago. That's how, in my mind, anything prior to March 13th, 2020 feels. And I'm no longer grieving the loss of whatever life was before. And honestly, I don't even I can't tactically like feel what it was like, because I feel like we've been so gripped in the now. But I do remember not having a care in the world to walk up to someone and give them a high five or a hug. I remember not looking at people that I know and love and wondering in the back of my mind whether or not I should get close to them or not. I remember just feeling like today's the day I'm going to go drop in and surprise my mom. Maybe bring her some flowers, take her to lunch at her favorite spot in La Jolla. One of the things that I really fell back in love with from afar is the ocean, because all of our beaches were closed here in Los Angeles County. And the act of surfing, which I've been doing for 32 years and has helped to shape me into the human being that I am today, was something that I no longer had access to. And it's interesting, right? When, you know, it's cliche as can be, but sometimes you don't appreciate what you have until it's gone. And whilst also being cut off from human contact, and then not having the outlet of the ocean and getting to go surfing for a couple of months, I just started taking a look back into the rearview mirror into what surfing has given me. And it's so much. I discovered surfing when I was on tour with my dad. I was 15 years old. And my father took me out of high school for a year to go on the road with him in 1987 on the Paul Simon Graceland tour. My dad was was a headliner on this tour that was one of the biggest tours in the world. If you're unfamiliar with the Grammy Award winning, globe smashing album, Paul Simon's Graceland, you should listen to it immediately. And you'll end up doing so more than once. The context for why this album is so incredible, I could literally just do a whole episode speaking about that time. Maybe one day I will. But the cliff notes are that my dad and I hadn't seen each other for about 5 years because he had gone to live in Africa. He wanted to be as close to South Africa as he could be while he was in political exile. In other words, my father couldn't physically go to the country of South Africa because he would possibly be jailed or killed, but he wanted to be on the continent. He hadn't been on the continent, and he just wanted to be in African energy. So he took off and lived in various countries in Southern Africa, not South Africa, but nearby in Southern Africa as well as West Africa. We didn't see each other for 5 years, which is tough when you're 10 and then you don't see your dad for 5 years. Important years, interesting years. I don't blame him. It was a hustle. It was tough. And anyway, my dad, I collaborated with Paul Simon, helped make it possible for Paul to secretly go into the country of South Africa and make music with South African musicians for this record.
I was aware of different African styles of music, mostly because of Hugh Masekela. as Hugh, who you know, Hugh knows that I'm very interested in different cultures, music, and he would show me different players in different styles, some from Ghana, some from Cameroon. He's a scholar of African music, of the continent of African music, and what was created is this music that really doesn't exist anywhere.
And in return for my dad helping Paul navigate the keys to get into the country and make music with these musicians, Paul not only invited my father on the road, but made him a headliner on this tour. It was Paul Simon, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Miriam Makeba, and Hugh Masekela.
It's the Graceland setup as it is right now, with Ladysmith Black Mambazo, with Miriam Makeba, with Hugh Masekela, and the Graceland Band, and Paul Simon. The best combination there has ever been?
No. I mean, like, we have unbelievable musicians in South Africa. I mean, like, they're very great. Really, really very great. And this is just a drop in the ocean. I think Graceland is just one little window. One little window in the Empire State Building of South Africa.
And it was actually Paul Simon's suggestion that my dad take me on the road. Paul Simon convinced my mother that it would be a good idea for her to let me get out of my sophomore year of high school for a few months and go on the road. He guaranteed my mom that I would be it would be his responsibility if anything happened to me. And my mom convinced my stepdad somehow that it was a good idea. And next thing you know, if you've seen the movie Almost Famous, That was me. The movie Almost, it's one of my favorite movies, Almost Famous. Shout out to Billy Crudup. I've never met you, but you standing on that roof, screaming out, "I'm a golden god, I'm on drugs," stuck with me for a lot of my life. But anyway, I got to go on this tour. I got to go out and be a roadie at 15, and we were in Australia for the bulk of that tour. And there was a roadie, a local road crew rigging guy who would come to work every day, and he would bring his surfboard to work with him. I didn't know anything about surfboard culture, but I'd always wonder why he had this surfboard backstage, and he would explain that he would go to the ocean and surf before coming to work, and I was fascinated. The board just looked so cool. And again, this is 1987. And I would ask him every day about surfing. Tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. And then finally he was like, "I'll point you out where you can go and watch." And I took a ferry from the Sydney Harbor to a local beach. And he told me where to go. I went to this little sandwich shop, bought a sandwich, and I went and sat exactly on the bench on a path next to the sand, where he told me I'd be able to watch the surfers. And sure enough, as I'm sitting there, these two kids that probably were about my age come jogging by, little skinny kids with surfboards. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to see what this is. And the waves were probably 2 to 3 feet. You know, if you're not a surfer, we call that, in surf speak, it was like chest high, bro. Yeah, like waist to chest high, occasionally a little bit bigger. Super fun, though. And these two kids sat on this little peak by themselves, and they started dancing. And I say dancing because for me, as a kid at that age, I was really into b-boying and breakdancing. And to me, these kids were breakdancing on water. Something about the rhythm and the dance and the personal flair and style. And it was just the two of them out there. And even though they were homies, it was like they were battling. It's like they were having a b-boy battle on water. And I just sat there slack-jawed. But like every time they did a move, my body was flinching. Like, whoo, whoo, like I was doing the move. And I was already mind surfing, even though I'd never surfed before. And I made a pact with myself that day. In May or so of 1987. I said, I don't know how. I don't know when. I don't know where. But when I get a chance to do this, I'm going to do this. Because that's amazing. I want to dance on water too. Fast forward to Carlsbad, California. And I met a bunch of kids that were really cool that surfed. And they took me out for lunch, which in my old school, you couldn't leave campus to go to lunch. That was only in the movies about California, but it couldn't be real. Yeah. We piled into this kid named Justin's Subaru hatchback and went to a new restaurant in my life called Carl's Jr. And they drove down to the beach and sat in the Tamarack Beach parking lot, pulled in, everyone's unwrapping their lunch, and they're looking out to the ocean keenly. And that's when I see it. Oh, they're floating on the water like these are surfers. And they're watching people catch waves, and they start talking this whole other language, talking about bottom turns and ripping and floaters, and tail slides and goofy and regular and front side and backside. That was sick. That was whack. And I'm tripping out, and then I just blurted out, I've seen this before. They're like, where? Where'd you see that, bro? I was like, in Australia. I was in Bondi Beach in Australia. I seen surfing last year. I was there. I was on tour with Paul Simon and my dad. Needless to say, they were like, sure you were. And I'm like, no. And I described it to the T that how I came to be in that situation and how I came to watch kids surfing in Sydney at Bondi Beach. And that I told myself that I wanted to do that and I'm here now and you guys do this thing. So how do I get to do it? And they're like, are you serious? I said, yeah, totally serious. And the one kid, Justin, said, be at my house on Saturday at 7 a.m. and we'll teach you how to surf. Got to Justin's on that Saturday morning. It's like six or seven kids. They're all really serious about their gear, putting on these neoprene wetsuit things I'd never seen before. They give me one. I ask where the bathroom is. Put the thing on, I come out, immediately all the kids just fall out laughing on the ground, like can't breathe, laughing and pointing at me, and I'm like, what's so funny? And it turns out that everything that I'd ever put on before that had a zipper meant that you were supposed to zip it up the front. Yes. All except for wetsuits. If a wetsuit has a zipper on it, it's meant to zip up the back. So, yours truly, standing there with the wetsuit on backwards. And I think it broke the ice because they were like, all right, this kid's cool. I went in. The wetsuit was too small for me anyway, so I had to like strip it off, put it back on the right way. And we made our way down to the beach. And they gave me a quick lesson about how to pop up on the board. Paddle, 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 pop up to your feet. So practice popping up. This first surfboard was a very small surfboard. It was a 5'11". Wave Tools quad fin. Never forget it. Justin's brother Jason let me borrow it. And the waves were sizable. It was probably like 4 to 6 feet on the sets. They told me explicitly, there's no way that you're going to make it out to the lineup. So just hang out in the whitewater. And the whitewater is the whitewash is the area where after the wave breaks, that white water comes sort of into the shore and then finally dissipates the last bit of energy from the swell in the ocean. Easy for you to sort of see it, take your board, jump on your stomach or on your boogie board or whatever, and ride it. And they said, you do that. Don't try to come outside. They all paddle out, and I'm awkward as can be on my board, legs splayed wide open, and I'm like, I'm getting out there. And I had a little bit of extra fire underneath me to want to make it out to where they were, A, because I was just curious, and B, because earlier in the week when I had told one of the kids in my economics class who had asked me how I was doing in my first week in Carlsbad, when I told him that I was excited that I'd met some kids that were going to teach me how to surf, he looked at me like I was crazy and said, yeah, that sounds cool and everything, but like, how are you going to learn how to surf? You guys don't even swim. And he didn't say it to me like he was making an effort to be racist. In fact, I think he felt like he was putting forth a public service announcement of sorts. Like, excuse me, Negro who finds himself amongst the shreddy Caucasians of Carlsbad. That's a great sentiment, but you are not navigators of the waters. How, pray tell, do you think you will be successful at our thing, this surfing? And I didn't get too pissed off, but I do remember it just lighting a fire in me where I was like, oh, I will show you. I will show all of you. And I paddled, and the waves would pick me up, and I'd just get destroyed, get thrown underwater. But I never panicked when I was underwater. Like, I would just come back up and grab the board and keep paddling and paddling no matter how many waves had smashed me. And I hung in there, and I finally made it out to the lineup during a lull between the sets. And the sets are the... And there's a swell that comes. It creates the waves that you see people riding. They come in rhythmic sets. Sometimes 10, 15 wave sets. Sometimes 5 to 6 wave sets. And then the ocean takes a break as that next bit of energy makes its way towards the shore. So I make it out there. And I'll never forget. The kids just like did a double take. I'm like, dude, how'd you get out here? It's insane. I don't know. I just kept paddling. I did what you said. I kept paddling. And they're like, all right, cool. I could tell they were like, oh, okay. I don't know if we've seen this before. This is amazing. They're giving me props for being out there. Then a set came. And I just remember the sheer awe of seeing a wave of this size coming towards me for the first time ever, as it's forming and not knowing what to do. And they're all scrambling to get into position. They're clearly reading the waves and putting themselves in position. And I didn't know what to do. And I remember screaming like, what do I do? And the kid Justin just looked at me and he turned to me. He's like, turn your board. Paddle now. Paddle hard, hard, hard. Paddle, 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 paddle. And I put my head down. And I paddled. I paddled as hard as I could. And I remember that feeling of just suddenly being weightless. Pure weightlessness. I'd never felt anything like it before. It's like that thing that you feel when you just get to the top of a roller coaster. Click, 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 click. And there's that little feeling right before you hear the screams and then shah, and you're going straight down. That's what it felt like. And next thing you know, I'm on my belly, and I'm going as fast as I've ever felt doing anything, except I'm on this board, on the water, and I'm bouncing all over the place, and I'm holding on for dear life as this thing is just chucking me around in the white water that's a few feet high, and then it's starting to dissipate, and I'm starting to feel like, okay, this thing isn't throwing me around so much, but I'm still riding, and I'm on my board, and I remember the kid saying in my head, I could hear him being like, when you feel like you can do it, put your hands on top of the board and pop up. Don't climb up. Just pop up to your feet. And I did it. I just snapped, popped up, and I landed on my feet. And now I'm riding water on this little board on my feet. And if the weightlessness associated with just catching the wave on my belly was foreign, this feeling, standing up just in the white water but moving on the wave on my feet, was intergalactic, like nothing I'd ever felt before in my life. Time started to slow down and almost went to what felt like a pause, like super slow motion. And it felt like the heavens parted. Something was poured out from the universe into me, and it started at the top of my dome, and it made its way through my mind and my chest and my heart and filled my entire body. And then suddenly time was moving fast again, and I was like, whoa! I think I was standing up at that time for maybe 5 or 6 seconds, and I fell off. I fell off the board, was underwater for a little while, and I just came shooting up. I felt like I jumped out of the water. I pressed off the bottom so hard, and I just screamed. I screamed as loud as I could until I was almost hoarse, and I was just smacking the water, and looking at this board, looking back out to the ocean, looking all around me. And in that moment, my life as I knew it was changed forever. Because I love surfing so much, because it's given me so much of the shape of who I am as a human being, I think that I definitely learned how to accept the microaggressions associated with ignorance, bigotry, and racism, as well as some of the more outright demonstrations over the years as normal. In other words, I learned to accept it as sort of a small price to pay for the bigger thing of what I love. And I got used to it. And I think that many people who, well, for sure, I know all the black people that I talk to that are surfers, learn the same. You love it so much that you're like, okay, you'll just put up with the things that come with it. And there are also an overwhelming amount of people that show you love and support. But it doesn't take away the sting and the sort of always having to be somewhat prepared for an incident every time you leave your house with your surfboard. Subliminally, you're doing more than just going surfing. You're sort of also like storing the response mechanisms necessary for how people choose to engage you, because you are different in the way you do the thing than they do the thing, and that requires some form of either comment, behavioral demonstration in your direction. And I learned to get used to it for the last 32 years. On June 3rd, I got to participate in something that I never thought I'd ever witness or be a part of in the surf community. If you think back to the end of May, in the wake of George Floyd's killing, tensions were beyond the call of high. The conversations nationally started to be about all these different landscapes in which racism and bigotry had been allowed to perhaps flourish unchecked or exist even in a quote-unquote minor way. Not that this it never feels minor, but in ways that were affecting the whole of various different subcultures within America. And during that time, of course, the conversation started to be had about surfing, about the surf community, and the surf community's responsibility or non-responsibility in some people's eyes, in many people's eyes still, but this idea of the responsibility in the conversation of inclusion and in what ways systemic racism may or may not be affecting the community. Surfing sort of picks and chooses where it likes to take its stand. And for the most part, it rarely gets political past defending the ocean, defending Mother Nature, defending the place where we love to play. And when faced with standing up for the ocean and for the environment, surfers become extremely vocal, are not immune to civil disobedience, and not immune to challenging the system and saying, hey, this is wrong. You can't build this here. And when it comes to race in surfing, it's been extremely tricky. An extremely tricky conversation that people don't like having. Because for most people who surf, they really do believe that, like, hey, man, we're all God's children in the ocean. And I don't see color, so why are you even bringing it up, man? You're actually fucking up the vibe by bringing this stuff up. And I don't want to talk about it because it's not a thing. So clearly you're playing the race card by even wanting to talk about it, because that's what you guys do. And it's bumming me out. But now, in the wake of what we're in, end of May 2020, where the entire country is having conversations about race and all of the different groups that make us up as a society, we're going to talk about it in surfing. And people seem to be open and eager to want to have a conversation. And more importantly, people within the surfing community have decided that they would like to take a stand and make their voices heard on the subject of police brutality and racism, which is something I never thought that I would see. I never thought that I would see mass groups of surfers be like, we're going to use the platform of our community to shine a light and to stand in solidarity and support. And so I got a call from my friends at Textured Waves, incredible black women who started their own platform on the gram, on the Instagram, their own page, to showcase black women particularly, but marginalized women as a whole within the surf community, to give them a place to shine and to storytell and to say, hey, surf industry, you can sell what this experience looks like in your own way, but also this. This is surfing. This is community. And we live this life. This is how we dance in the thing. Founded by four different black women in Florida, Santa Cruz, San Diego, and Hawaii. I discovered them about 7-8 months ago, and when I found their page, I just couldn't stop smiling. Deep diving every day, just seeing all of these black women enjoy in surfing as a collective. Never seen it before. Never seen the stories told like that before, and people engaging and seeing it and being inspired by it. Danielle, Black Lions of Textured Waves, reached out to me and said, hey, we're going to do a paddle out for George Floyd in your hometown, adopted hometown, hometown of Encinitas, California, and we think you should come down and be a part of this alongside the folks from Changing Tides Foundation and Kind Humans Movement. All as organizers, we'd like you to come on board as an organizer and come down and speak. I lived in Encinitas for 17 years. And in that 17 years, in one of the most wave-rich, incredible surf communities in the world. I mean, surfing is a part of how and why this place operates. Like, everything is based around the ocean, generationally. Some of you might be asking, well, what's a paddle out? A paddle out is a ceremony shared with us from Polynesian and Hawaiian culture to honor the passing of someone within the community, within the tribe. When a surfer or someone within the surf community loses their life, surfers get together on the beach. There's our speeches, their ceremony to put into context this person's life, to celebrate their existence, and they're moving on. And then all of the surfers get in the water on their surfboards, paddle out past where the waves are breaking, form a giant circle holding hands, sitting on their surfboards. And send that person off. Celebrate that person moving on. And their spirit and their energy. And flowers are thrown into the center and the water is splashed. And people yell from the depths of their soul and scream in unison to honor that person's life. And as we got gathered on the beach, I saw, like, whoa, there's already people here. People were taking surfboards and they were strategically placing them in the sand to spell the word unity. And there were probably about 75 people when I got there. And I thought, well, there'll maybe be a couple of hundred, 250. That would be amazing. I started to feel some optimism, but I had no idea. Because at Moonlight Beach is it's at the base of a hill. That there's a little plateau at the top before it, in the middle of the hill, before it goes back up a steep part. And on that plateau is a parking lot. So you can't see necessarily people coming from the top of the hill. But you just see more people coming over the ridge of this plateau. More and more people. More and more people. More and more people. and families with their kids, and people had signs, and they had decided to turn their surfboards into protest placards. And they'd written the names of not just George Floyd, but of Breonna Taylor and Sandra Bland and Eric Garner and Philando Castile and Trayvon Martin and so many other names I saw across all the bottoms of these various surfboards. And people had clearly put in hours of work to make these displays. And I was slack-jawed. It is difficult for me to put into words what that felt like to see. To see mothers and fathers with their kids who were 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, knowing that this was an important day for them as parents to showcase to their kids how you stand up for what's right. You could see in the eyes of the kids that their parents had had conversations with them about why they were going and what they were going to do. And there was resolve on the faces of these people that were coming over the hill. Solemn, steely resolve on the faces of mostly white people come in town to this beach. And the hundreds started piling up on hundreds. And there were so many faces that I had grown up with and known within the last 25, 30 years. And to see those kids that I had grown up with that are now adults with their kids and just looking me in the eye, nodding ahead even, many times not even needing words as to why they were there. And in the end, I think there were 2,000 people that showed up on that beach. So much so that there wasn't room for everyone on the beach, and people were up on the plateau of the first part of the parking lot, and they were watching from there. And they had flowers and lays. And it was a magic day. Oh, there was no wind. The sun was crispy warm, and the ocean danced in a bunch of different blues as the sun was on its way to setting. I will never forget that. I will never forget how it made my heart feel. I remember Danielle and the other women from Textured Waves. We were just all just looking at each other like, wait, what? Cried joy tears that this community that we love to play in and we all share this passion for what dancing on the waves in the ocean gives us, yet this community that we didn't quite know how to feel 100% a part of because of this asterisk that is our melanin. But on this day, we felt embraced not just as surfers. We felt embraced in the totality of who we are as Black people in this experience and in this community. We felt embraced in the totality of our humanity. And it was love. It was the most powerful expression of love I've ever felt in surfing. And as the ceremony started, different members of our group of organizers took turns on a bullhorn, speaking from the top of the lifeguard station. And then at the end, they passed me the bullhorn and asked me to be the last speaker. And when I walked up to the edge of the railing, holding that bullhorn and looking out into this sea, this beautiful sea of human beings that also included other young black surfers that now live in the community with their parents. It is very difficult for me to even explain how it felt. I was in awe. And in the midst of all of the back and forths and the race baiting and the hyper-politicizing of, you know, taking the protest out of it and people just wanting to focus on the violence or looting that had taken place and ignoring the whole of the thing and why we're even in this situation in the first place. There was just this powerful sense of peace that came over me. And I took a deep breath. And I felt a real sense of calm come over me. And then a bunch of words came out from my heart that I didn't plan to say.
This has been the hardest week in my 48 years in this planet. It's been the hardest week to exist in my skin and in my blackness. It has been that way for all of us that have this skin to wonder what it is and as to whether or not we get to be Americans just like everyone else. But for all of the surfers that happen to be black, we've known and experienced challenges in this community that would probably shock you, because it's been very hard for people to perceive, perhaps, that people that don't look like them can love the ocean as much as they do. Racism is not a thing that we will stand for in the United States of America. We're going to take the full 8 minutes and 46 seconds that George Floyd experienced in that brutal lynching that we watched on television. We're going to take that full 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence, and then we're going to paddle out and honor his life. Officer, I can't breathe.
I can't breathe.
I can't breathe. Mama. Mama. Mama, I can't breathe. And there's something about this pandemic that we've been existing in that has acted like a blacklight and exposed any of our systems that simply just don't work. But I do believe in the America that we can be. And as I look out right now at this crowd, this is the America that we can be. I hope that you guys will be here tomorrow and the next day and the next day and continue to stand for this thing that we call unity and tell racism that it can go and kick rocks. Because that's not what surfing is about.
What do we want?
Surfing!
When do we want it?
Now!
But I said them all for the first time out loud because nothing was holding me back. I knew in that moment that if I spoke my truth, people were going to listen. They just wanted to listen. And then when I was done, after engaging with the crowd in 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence on this beach to honor George Floyd, which was so powerful. And then when I was done, we all paddled out. Over 1,000 people, I think, paddled out. The biggest circle I've ever been in. It feels like something has shifted within the surfing community. And it gives me hope for the future of this thing that I love so, so much. It gives me an immense, immense amount of joy and hope. So, with that, when I first discovered Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, PhD, leading oceanographer and voice in the conversation and in the fight for our oceans and environment in America, when I first discovered that Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, PhD, was a black woman from Brooklyn who just so masterfully and astutely could explain the ocean and our climate challenges and the majesty of the ocean and her relationship with it, when I would watch her in talks online, when I started to read her writing in various spaces, it's very difficult to put in the context how the amount of beaming pride I had that this woman existed, that a black woman from Brooklyn was the leading voice in the fight, that she is the woman that the world's most powerful people choose to listen to and learn from. About our oceans, about environmentalism, and about the intersection of our oceans and our environment as it relates to social justice. Every time I've ever heard this woman speak, I'm just like, yo, Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is a boss. I need to meet this woman in real life someday. And as weird fate would have it, as I became an ambassador for the WSL's Pure Foundation, which is heavily steeped in conservation and preservation of our oceans, guess who else is an ambassador for WSL Pure? Why, yes, Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. And I'm like, yo, we're on the same team? That's crazy. I don't know her, but our photos are very close to each other. Then I'm having a conversation with one of my agents in New York City who helps me with my television career. And I bring up Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson And she's like, oh, well, we represent her as well. In fact, I represent her for her television ends of things. I'm like, come on. Are you telling me that I'm double on the same team with Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson? That's insane. Yeah, I'll get you guys connected. Stop it. Neither one of those two things are being peer ambassadors and also having the same agency actually got us together. And finally, I just said, you know what? I'm going to do this the new-fashioned way. I'm going to shoot Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, PhD, founder and CEO of Ocean Collective and founder of the Urban Ocean Lab, Harvard grad. I'm going to shoot her a DM. I am going to politely knock on the door of her direct messages and see perhaps if she would like to engage in a conversation and exchange on the What Shapes Us podcast. And you know what? Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, PhD, responded on the same day with a simple, yes, I would love to. No lie, I danced around my home. That's how happy I was. And as you're about to see, we had ourselves a conversation and a half. I'm just so grateful to Ayanna for jumping on and having this conversation with me. She really opened up and revealed a lot. And you can hear she loves the ocean as much as a human being can love it. And I know what that feeling is. And you can hear that passion in her voice. And it's more than passion. You know, when she says that she's working to try to help us save ourselves and save this planet, I believe it. She's someone who just lives this and studies the science in how our planet behaves. And she's working to do all she can to stop us from getting to the place and the point of no return when it comes to the role that we play in harming this big, beautiful, magic planet that we inhabit, especially when it comes to our oceans. And as you'll hear in this conversation, she's really keen on highlighting and showcasing to us why it is that our environmental justice and social justice are in the same bag. They intersect heavily, and you can't pull them apart if you want to. This is a fun conversation. I hope that you enjoy it. Again, I just couldn't be more grateful. This is episode 2 with Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, PhD. I'm really, really grateful to you, Ayanna. I so desperately want to call you Dr. Johnson, but then...
You can call me Dr. Johnson. I don't want to, like, step on your toes if you want to
be called
formal.
You Dr. Johnson in your note, you're like, it's Ayanna. And oh my God, we're going to be familiar.
Yeah, we can be familiar. I'm down. The headphones are like a weird... It's like it like wants to be a headband. I'm never quite sure, like, what is the Afro-compatible, like, just, like, kind of put them in the back?
I think it's cool there because you end up getting, like, a bonus really hip hairstyle.
Like a flat top.
Yeah, like a really dope flat top. For a person like me who used to be you, like, someone who had, like, dynamic and notable hair for most of his career.
Dynamic and notable hair. That is... Those are some good adjective choices.
It's true. You have dynamic and notable hair.
It gets more dynamic and more notable every month of quarantine that goes by, too.
You're killing it. I was never able to get that. I had a dread afro, and then
It sank. Gravity.
I twisted it. Gravity. Yeah.
No, but my hair is like, fuck gravity. We're going up. Only up.
Just only up. which is a nice sort of, your hair is like a metaphor of hope for.
If my hair has anything to say about it, we will definitely just solve the climate crisis this decade, for sure.
Yeah. If
and clean up the ocean. This is all going to be included, right?
Yeah. These are going to be
solid gold.
This will actually be the clips.
Hair
the
tips.
Hair discussion will
from
be
Salema
the
clips. Salema and Ayana.
Will be
am the, I pronouncing the, your name correctly?
Salema?
Salema.
Yeah. Salema Mabena Masakela. Mabena.
Mabena just M-B?
Yeah, M-A-B.
M-A-B.
M-A-B-E-N-A. If we were like, yeah, Masakela. And for years I was Sal. To be more palatable, digestible.
I'm glad you've given up on being palatable.
I always wanted to do it, and I tried to do it at different times in my career. Mm-hmm. And I would always get massive pushback, usually from studio heads, agents, etc. It's the brand. I mean, come on. It's the brand. Why do you want to mess up the brand? And when I first started in television, I would be fonted as Salema, and people mm-hmm. would call me Sal, but at least mm-hmm. it was there. My name was there. Mm-hmm. Salema was also my grandfather's name. And then one day this executive was like, look, if you're going to be the star that you want to be, we need to win the Midwest. And
yeah,
the Midwest cannot pronounce what's on the screen.
Salema?
Yeah. I mean, when I moved to California from New York.
I think we just lower the bar too much for each other all the time.
We do.
Come on, you guys. This is totally doable.
When I moved to California from New York, from the East Coast, to Southern California, the kids were like, so what? Bro, that's hard. And within a few days, a kid
came up
to me. They're
like, we're going to call you X. Yeah.
And they came up to me with Sal like they had discovered fire. Bro, you're Sal. And everyone's like, Sal. And they did a little dance. And then that's how it was born. And I was fighting it up until this time. Literally, and this is going to sound strange, but after George Floyd, which was after Breonna Taylor, which was after Ahmaud Arbery, which was after the Central Park incident, and the fact that we all had our focus on these things, and mm-hmm. you're starting to deal with all the stuff that we as Black people deal with just trying to exist with this energy in the air, mm-hmm. I woke up one morning and I said, if Black people are going to continue to die just for being Black, then I'm going to lose anything that makes me more palatable and less Black and easy for people to digest. Mm-hmm. And it just was an instant thing where I was just like, that's it. It's today.
If I have to walk out of my door every day as a Black person, then you're just going to have to learn my name.
Yes. and that was it. And yeah. I went on Instagram that morning and I did like a pronunciation for everyone of mm-hmm. what Salema Mabena Masakela was and changed the Instagram and freedom!
I mean, once it's changed on Instagram, that's like a legal...
It's like going to the post office. It's changed.
My name is, so I was born in 1980 and in Brooklyn in the 80s, just like my name felt super weird. People had like, I wanted an 80s white girl name so bad. Like I wanted to be Lisa or Jennifer or Stephanie, like just give me some sort of like weird, not weird name, right? They like, it wasn't, it was the age of like three syllable names. I had three syllables, but it was such a weird one. And You'll appreciate this. So my dad's Jamaican and my mom's white. She grew up on Long Island from an Irish Catholic family. And so when my mom was pregnant, she was like, okay, we need to give this kid a name. I think we should give her a black name. My dad was probably like, okay, Louise, whatever you want. So my mother like marches herself to the Brooklyn Public Library, checks out an African name book, takes it home and is like flipping through and is like, Ayana, beautiful flower. That's a really nice name. We'll name her Ayana. And I'm like, Mom, you couldn't even get past A. You know, like, were you not committed to this research project? And she's like, I got to the end of the A's, Ayana, and it was such a good one. And I hated it for so long because it was so weird and people didn't know how to pronounce it. It was like Ayana or Anaya or Ayana or whatever. Mm. Alana, just anything. And now I love it.
It's beautiful.
I, at the time, I was like, beautiful flower is so much pressure. It's so much ego. And now I'm like, there's so many different kinds of flowers and they're all beautiful. Just like, it's great. It's actually not a lot of pressure. You got this. And then Elizabeth is also my mom's middle name. So I have an attachment to that. And then Johnson's, you know, my dad's slave name. So there you go.
Just your name is literally the last 400 years.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is Dr. Ayana Elizabeth Johnson. And so when I'm in a meeting and people try to get all formal and they're like, Ms. Johnson, and I'm like, if we're being formal, it's actually doctor, which is like the only time I ever correct people is if someone tries to Ms. me in a formal meeting. I'm just like, you can use doctor.
That's,
you can call me Ayana.
Really cool. That's such a great superpower to have.
Only if someone's
to.
Being a jerk, you know? Like, yeah. I'm not trying to like make enemies for no reason, but if someone's trying to wield their power over me in a professional setting by like being falsely formal, I'm just mm-hmm. like, sure.
Like, for instance,
Mr. Smith, it's actually Dr. Johnson if we're being formal.
Right. So like, excuse me, miss, perhaps you didn't understand, and then you're like, actually,
it's doctor, it's totally doctor. Get it. This is what happens when you get me on a Friday afternoon. I'm just like, should we be saving the planet or just like figuring out who we are and how we want to be in the world?
I love it. I love that this is how I'm getting you. You posted something on Twitter a couple of weeks ago that really got my attention, where you asked, if you weren't working on social justice right now, or in this fight with your energy mm-hmm. and time and soul, what would you be doing right now?
Mm-hmm.
And the responses were heartbreaking.
Totally.
Because
totally heartbreaking.
All everyone was saying was the most simple things in life that mm-hmm. they wanted to be doing, or something that they've had on their bucket list that they wanted to do. And all of the things were pleasant and fun and things that you just think everyone should have access to.
So this came up because I hosted an Instagram Live with 10 of my friends, and that was for Juneteenth. And I asked them, you know, what Juneteenth meant to them. If anything, I asked them, you know, to tell us about their work. And I asked them, you know, if white supremacy didn't exist, if we didn't need to fight for racial justice, what would you be doing instead? What would you do with your time? And it was really hard to hear those answers, because people would have entirely different careers. Like, instead of trying to dismantle the prison industrial complex, they would have been an artist. Instead of organizing Black Lives Matter rallies and marches in New York City, another one would have been a music teacher. Instead of, I have a friend who does like amazing films about justice, who would have loved to be an astronomer. She would have discovered some like dope other galaxy for sure, right? Other people just said, you know, I would spend time with my kids. Like, I am so committed to this work for the greater good that I don't spend enough time with my family. And I would just read more books. And we'll spend more time gardening with my mom. Just like that stack of books that you never have the energy to get to because you're just like watching another black person get murdered for no reason and traumatized by it. But the answer on Twitter that actually broke my heart was a guy who was like, I would be an archaeologist. And the fact that we have this massive drain of intellect and creativity, just the millions of people in the United States alone that are fighting for their basic rights to live and breathe instead of building a more beautiful world for all of us and discovering a bunch of cool shit along the way, right? Like, I want to know what weird dinosaur that guy was going to discover and what planet my friend would have found. And yeah, it's really sad. And I am one of the lucky few that actually got to follow her childhood dreams.
Your story, by the way, I read your Washington Post op-ed to your colleagues. That shit was fire.
I was a bit fed up when I was writing that. That was like just fury and grief mashed up into formal sentences somehow.
I felt all of it. Like, even though I'm not in your line of work, I felt all of it. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very powerful. And you spoke about so many things that subconsciously we're all doing to operate as black people during this time. I say that if you, I tried to explain it to a white friend the other day, that if you took your phone and you opened up all the apps and you turned all your brightness up on your phone and all the apps are running all at once and you just stuck it in your pocket. And then at the end of the day, you expect your battery to have full life.
Nope.
And he was,
not possible.
I said, that's impossible, right? He said, yeah. I said, well, that's what it's like being black and operating in these times. And he got emotional. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that weird analogy from outer space made sense to him because the thing was in his pocket. But it was powerful how you put that and gave and you were also able to feel the passion of how much you love what you do, what you've gone to school to do, what you've been chasing since you were a child, to be able to say in a room, it's doctor, sir. I felt all of that, and I thought it was really brave and beautifully done. And also, like, you don't want to get compliments for that. We shouldn't even be talking about that article. We should be talking about your work.
But I'm really glad I wrote it because... So it's basically framed as a letter to white environmentalists, right? Explaining to them how it's impossible for me to make a full contribution to the climate movement, to ocean conservation, while living within this violent and deadly system of white supremacy. And... leading and so I think in this historical moment, this remarkable moment of inflection, I think a lot of us are struggling with how can we contribute? Like, what's the thing that we can do that's important? And noticing just the sort of awkward silence of environmental groups early on, I was like, we need you. We need you because you need us. You need to be welcoming people of color into the climate movement, into the environmental movement, because you just cannot win otherwise. Like, we need to build the biggest possible team, right? So we have to have each other's backs. And we have to lift this burden of racial injustice off of everyone so we can all just forge ahead with this other work that needs doing. And so... in thinking about what I could contribute in this moment, I thought, well, how am I perceived in that world? And my reputation is as someone who like works really hard and is productive and has a fancy resume. And so like, how can I use that? And I was like, well, if I admit that in this moment I am overwhelmed and I am shutting down and I can't go on like it's business as usual, then maybe people who know me, maybe people who can relate to that feeling of being overwhelmed and exhausted, maybe I that can use that as an opening to talk about the ways in which we need to do better and connect the intertwined issues of race and climate as we move forward.
Yeah, it was beautiful the way you explained all the things that you had been unable to accomplish as a result.
I'm still catching up.
And within that, I mean, you've always spoken about this intersection of social justice and environmentalism on many levels, and because people like to think of environmentalists as being people who buy $14 smoothies at Erewhon, but the people who are really affected by climate change and by environmental disasters tend to be people who have less. Mm-hmm. And tend to be people who are people of color and black people. And not just from an event standpoint, but also from like an institutional standpoint, to be like, where can we build this thing that is horrible for the environment, but serves the masses? Well, we can't build it in
power plant, highway.
Right.
Yeah, where should we put these things?
Oh, we'll just run it right through this black neighborhood. They'll be fine. They'll absolutely be fine. And I love the way that you've made that connection palatable in a way where people don't have a choice but to pay attention.
I think the layer that I was able to add to this discussion is what you've described. This concept of climate justice has finally started to break through in the last few years, right? People of color are more heavily impacted by the effects of climate change, by storms, by sea level rise, by air pollution. That is kind of understood. More or less. There are the people who are like, climate change is coming for all of us, so that argument doesn't sway me. I'm like, well, the math is not on your side, bro. Like, it's hurting some people more than others, so like, let's take care of the hurt.
If I don't feel it, it's not here.
It's like the all lives matter approach to climate change. I'm like, yes, everyone's going to get hurt by climate change eventually, but like also true that some people are like already getting screwed. So let's like not lose our humanity. And so I think that climate justice concept has actually broken through a bit, and people are starting to talk about that. But I think what gets lost in the conversation when we don't include race is just who is included and who is not in building the solutions that we need. Are we sort of draining the 13% of Americans who are black? Is there so much burden on them from living in this horrible racist context that they can't actually be part of the solution? Because we need everybody. And being able to make that case, I think, that we were going to lose unless we addressed racism, because we would just not have the right people working on this, not have enough people working on this. And being able to point out that people of color are actually much more concerned about climate change than white people. So this myth that the standard environmentalist is some, you know, white dude wearing a Patagonia jacket, driving a Prius, like looking off into the distance on some
checking
trail.
All the boxes.
Yeah. With, you know, with some fancy latte and his reusable stainless steel, whatever. It's just like, that is actually not the average environmentalist. The Environmental Voter Project's data shows that an environmentalist is more likely to be, a Latina grandma in Arizona than it is a white guy in New England. Because 49% of white people are concerned about climate, 57% of black people, and 70% of Latinx people. There's culturally a more egalitarian worldview that says we all need to chip into these bigger problems, and being more impacted as well, secondarily. So being able to say, like, since black people are 13% of America and 57 of them are concerned with climate, The math works out that that is 23 million Black people who already care about the climate crisis, who could be working on solutions in one way or another, bringing their skills to the table if we didn't have to deal with still in 2020 explaining to the world why Black lives matter and that they have not mattered. And that is the number that will stick in my heart forever, that there's 23. It's not like we worry so much about how to convince climate deniers that climate change is real, instead of saying, and we worry about if we talk about Black Lives Matter, maybe we'll scare away white people who care about climate but don't want to deal with the complexities of race, and let's not scare those people away. We need those people. And I'm like, what about the 23 million Black people who already care and we don't have to convince? Like, why are we so much more worried about scaring white people away from the climate movement than we are welcoming people of color in? Because that's a choice. That shows me your priorities. Mm. And I get it, because like I do have sympathy for the fact that dealing with the climate crisis is already like the biggest problem, literally the biggest problem in the world, right? And so no one wants to make that harder and more complicated than it already is. So I understand the sort of impulse to be like, let's just not deal with that. We're trying to save all of humanity by stopping the climate emergency. And it's just, I wish we could separate the two, but it's humans who created the problem, and it's humans who are being impacted by it, and it's humans who could fix it. So like, you can't just ignore the humans part. Yeah. And pretend that you can have like justice somewhere but not other places, and like, don't worry, it'll all work out.
Also exposing the manner in which people truly are affected by climate change,
mm-hmm.
validates the actual issue of systemic racism and all the things that aren't working in a way that messes up the messaging of how people would like to frame it. So it's like, yeah. Well, if you put the light over there, then you're showing everything else that is of actual importance, and the fact that all of these things are connected. When I first discovered you...
Are you Christopher Columbus in this analogy? Please say no.
Did you just make me a colonizer? Are you?
I did. My bad.
When you first came into my purview.
Okay, better.
By the way, I only graduated high school, so purview is a very expensive word for me.
Super big.
But when you first came into my lens, I was so blown away that the most prominent voice in America really beating the drums about our oceans and sustainability and solving this as a global problem and really as it relates to all of humanity,
mm-hmm.
was this Black woman from Brooklyn.
Surprise!
I was like...
You didn't see it coming.
I was dancing, like, with
Joe. Oh.
Because as what I like to call an only,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you are one of the only Black people within your space, you know, what's necessary for people to think of you as being, or to accept you as being an authority, you know, what that journey means,
mm-hmm.
you have to have walked through that to know. And especially when it comes to the ocean. Yeah. And so I just was like, this is amazing. And not only is she the person, but she's remarkably cheery about the worst thing that's happening in our universe. Like the delivery of like, and possibility and belief and hope, but also like, let me give you this science.
I definitely like have to remind myself about the hope part, because it's just not in my DNA. Like, that's not how I was raised. I don't need hope to act, right? And I think that when you come from a working class background or a poor background. And, you know, my father was an immigrant from Jamaica. And, you know, my mother grew up one of seven. Like, you don't expect the world to open every door for you. You just do it anyway, even though you're not sure what the outcome is going to be. And that's actually how I feel about ocean conservation. That's how I feel about the climate crisis. Like, I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if everything we're doing is going to actually be enough. But how ridiculous and privileged is it to just not try? Like, of course we have to try. We have to do everything we can to create a better world. Everyone needs to contribute in whatever their way, their skill set, their resources allow. And so I've been known when people are like, what brings you hope? I'm just like, fuck hope. Let's just get to work. Right? Which is like not a winning argument, because people, like a lot of people are motivated by hope.
Yeah.
I'm just really lucky that I'm not one of those people, because I would probably get a lot less done if I were waiting to be hopeful all the time.
There's a brightness to your delivery that makes like the sting of the science and the truth hit different.
Hmm.
That's how I would describe it. So it's like a Trojan horsing. Maybe it's unintentional, clearly, but you're getting people's attention.
Well, good.
How did your relationship with the ocean come about, being a girl from Fort Greene, Brooklyn?
Yeah. Which is now bougie as hell, but was absolutely the ghetto in the 80s.
I grew up in Staten Island.
Yeah.
And I wasn't
My friends allowed. Were not allowed to come visit me.
I was just about to say, I was not allowed as a teenager, like, to go and hang out. Like, if my parents found out that I was hanging in your neighborhood, I would be grounded for weeks.
Yeah.
I could go with my family to visit my Puerto Rican family that lived in your neighborhood, but I could not go by myself.
Yeah. So I grew up in Brooklyn. We went on a family vacation when I was five. My parents decided it was time for me to learn how to swim. And so we went to Florida. It was the only family vacation we could afford to go on. And it totally changed my life. I learned to swim. I went on a glass bottom boat ride, and I saw the entire underwater universe and was just like, why did nobody tell me about this? This is amazing. And what is it called when this is your job? Like, I want looking at this stuff and understanding it to be my job. Like holding a sea urchin in the palm of my hand and feeling its crazy tube feet crawl across my palm, and seeing an electric eel in the aquarium and all of it. I was just like, this is now my life.
At five.
I mean, but every kid like has a dream job when they're five. And so many people wanted to be a marine biologist. In fact, it's like, you can always tell my mood at parties when someone's like, oh my God, I wanted to be a marine biologist when I was a kid. And by depending on my answer, you can see like sort of how high or low my battery is, like how drained I am, or how much of a jerk I've decided this person is. Because sometimes I'll be like, oh, cool. And sometimes I'll be like, well, should have followed your dreams.
What's that? You couldn't get into Harvard.
No, I would never say that.
I would.
Getting into Harvard is meaningless.
If I was next to you, I'd be like, I'm sorry, were you unable to get into Harvard? Like, the doctor? I'm sorry.
It's just such an awkward question, because people are like, I wanted to do that. And you're just like, sorry?
And?
Or like, why didn't you? And then they want to ask you about dolphins. And I'm like, I don't know anything about dolphins. It sort of very quickly devolves. But I think, you know, everyone has this first love as a child. I think a lot of kids who have the opportunity to experience the ocean in a safe way as a kid are enamored with it. I mean, it's amazing. Indisputably. Like octopuses, bananas. Like, how could you not want to know more? And so, you know, I started a shell collection and I came back to Brooklyn and, you know, then I learned about the civil rights movement and I decided that my dream job was actually to be the lawyer that got the next Martin Luther King out of jail. Like, super specific. Don't want to be assassinated. Want to be extremely helpful to the movement. in like a nerdy behind the scenes way. And then I wanted to be a park ranger when I went on my first backpacking trip in the Southwest. I was like, clearly walking around in the forest all day is the best job on the planet. I want that job. And then I wanted to be like an environmental lawyer and do policy work. And then I was actually doing policy at the EPA right out of college. I was like, you know what? I could do all of those things at the same time, and that would be ocean conservation. You're like the scientist, park ranger, caring about the justice of coastal communities and helping shape policy.
Like and Iron Woman.
All of the above. Anytime there's a choice, I'm like, all of the above. Give
straight up Iron Woman. Iron Woman.
I'll take one of
each.
That's so amazing. So that's sort of the evolution, and I've just been really holding on to working at that intersection for my entire career, which is, you know, a little bit tricky. People want you to specialize and, you know, become an expert in one narrow thing, especially when you're doing a PhD. But, you know, I did a chapter on fisheries, and I did a chapter on policy. I did a chapter on behavioral economics and chapters on socioeconomics of the fishing community, and hundreds of interviews with fishermen and scuba divers, and hundreds of dives understanding the impact of different types of fishing gear, because it's so important to be able to think of all of these major challenges we face, whether it's ocean or climate or racial injustice. These are crazy puzzles. We have to have some understanding of all the pieces so we can help fit them together. And there's some people who are like super duper experts on one piece, And I have them on speed dial, but that's not me, right? I'm the one who's like, how are we gonna, like, does this, no, who has that piece? Can someone call that person? Oh, wait, like, I know that person. Okay. And which university and which lab and, like, which report is that in? And how do we craft the argument and how do we get people on board with it? And I find that endlessly fascinating in a way that the pure science of it wouldn't be able to hold my interest for decades in a career. Like, I read the science and I love it, but actually doing lab work, I held a pipette once and I made someone take a picture. I was like, this is never happening again. Someone document this.
In listening to your first TED Talk, watching it, I was fascinated by how excited you got about the sociology aspect
of
your job. And I thought it was really interesting because, I mean, one of the main things that you talk about repetitively is the ocean's not being about fish. The fish are good. They're doing their job. The ocean conservation is a human discussion on so many different levels. Yeah. But seeing the work that you were doing, especially early on in the Caribbean, and spending time with fishermen and not taking them out of their element, but like sitting in the midst of
my... Oh, no, I would show up with a cooler full of beer and be like, tell me everything.
Yeah.
I've got time.
What is that like choosing to sort of take the ego of what you've learned and the titles that you've been given for what you've learned and just engaging with human beings to get to the essence of problem solving with the actual people affected?
I guess I don't think it was that hard because they knew more than me. So me having an ego would be absurd. Like, these are fishermen who have spent decades on and under the water. I'm like, tell me what you know, if you would be so kind, please, like, help me understand this ecosystem. How much has it changed over the last 20, 30, 50 years? What stories did you hear from your grandparents? You know, do you want your kids to do this? Is there a future in this work? If, you know, what kinds of regulations would you support? What do you think the problem really is? Like, what are the main threats? So these were things, you know, as a grad student just showing up, like, I don't know. And there's a lot of people who do think they know and come in with a lot of swagger, but I was just like, around with folding chairs and a cooler full of beer in my trunk for a few months and talked to like almost every fisherman on the island and then the dive instructors in Curacao, and was just really determined to understand all the layers of these challenges, right? You've got this sort of post-colonial, neo-colonial scenario with the Netherlands. You've got the role that fishing used to play in the community, but it's so much harder to make a living now. So there's all these sort of gender dynamics around, like, who's the head of the household in a context where fishing is no longer profitable. There's just needing to adapt and try to get fancier gear so you can go offshore, and not being able to get loans for that kind of stuff, and having to do jobs on the side in order to keep fishing, which is the thing that you really love, and just being heartbroken at seeing these ecosystems that you depend on, sort of the wealth of your island and community, fall apart. And having these people open up to me about all of the complexities in that, all of the nuance around race and class and government and politics and economics and culture and just the humanity of what we do defines us. And we're really attached to the professional part of our identity. And what does it mean if you can't do that anymore? So it was really humbling, actually, person after person just telling me how much I didn't know. But the question that I learned the most from was asking, if you could write the rules to manage the ocean, what would they be? And so many people were like, no one's ever asked me. I've never thought about it because I never thought my opinion would matter. And some people didn't have an answer. And then like a week later, I'd see them at the dock and they'd be like, I've got it. and some people had great answers right away. And it's the same when people are like academically approaching the Black Lives Matter movement. And they're like, what can we as an organization do to help? I'm like, I don't know. Why don't you ask someone instead of like focus grouping it and crafting some perfectly meaningless poetic statement, and instead ask the Black leaders in your community what they need, and then don't make a big deal out of having provided it. Don't wage a whole marketing campaign over your tiny donation or contribution or whatever.
Everyone, look at what we did for the Blacks, please.
Yeah.
Come see before it's no longer relevant.
Yeah, that. Don't do that. So yeah, I mean, I think I try to just be super practical. Like, there's so much work to do. And so I try to just think, what can I actually help with? Right? That matters. And that's, you know, partially just as I age and have like, and think more strategically about how I spend my time, and know my limits much better and what I'm not great at. It's been really a joy to embrace the sort of amorphous middle role that I've created for myself between science and policy and culture and justice.
It's amazing how wisdom and time under tension starts to breed this level of efficiency that you never in a million years thought you'd be capable of. Because
I would not claim that I'm efficient, by the way. Those are not my words. I don't think I deserve those words.
I call it efficiency in that I say, relative to me now, I used to say yes to everything that people asked me to do because, well, clearly I need to be there if people think I need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And realize that I was accomplishing nothing. And then learning the power of no, taking advantage of the fact that I know people who are far smarter than me in those spaces.
I love recommending other people. I'm like, this person is actually better for that.
Yeah. And then being able to do what I'm good at. By the way, I'm a chronic procrastinator. Highly unorganized.
Mm-hmm.
But I somehow managed to get shit done by the skin of my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But that, being able to apply all those things, that all those imperfections to the thing that I love, is that's my version of efficiency.
I like to think of it as all the time you're procrastinating, you're actually thinking about it in the back of your head. So by the time you sit down to do it, you've actually been working on it for a while.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I feel like I owe you money. I really do. But it's, I feel like the older that I get, the more I just know the things that I don't want to be associated with, and I get really, really excited about the things that I have left to do, and what their importance mm-hmm. are.
Turns out people do not like it when you say no to them. When you're like, sorry, yes. I can't make it. They're like, wait, what? I was like, sorry, you know, too busy. They're like, what? No, we're going to ask you again. We saw your out of office message, but we just wanted to make sure you didn't miss this opportunity. So we're emailing you 3 more times. And then we're going to have our boss email you. And you're like, you guys.
No.
No.
It's also, which is a superpower. Like, the more you say no, the more you're like, no, no, no.
I hope that kicks in soon. The vibrato of the resounding no. That's my goal for the second half of 2020.
I will record you some different levels, intonations of the vibrato no. And then you can just play that for people.
Yeah,
I mean, cool. You gave me an incredibly expensive word. It's the least that I can do. I've wondered this relative to being an only mm-hmm. in your field and space. What type of obstacles at a micro and larger when it comes to like, excuse me, are you supposed to be here? Have you experienced along the way in your field where you still maybe might find yourself having to justify that, like, no, this is my shit?
This is going to sound self-aggrandizing, but I dress really well professionally. And so this is less a problem for me because I look like I'm supposed to be there. I'm like clearly not there by mistake, you know? If anything, they're like, are you supposed to be at the black tie event down the hall? Because like, this seems like you're slumming it. No. The last like really remarkable experience that I had like that, and I will say I haven't had that many, in part because a lot of my work was in the Caribbean, in part because, you know, I don't have terribly high sensitivity for that, like microaggressions. I'm just like, I don't think about them. I'm just like, that person is like not totally with it. And they're like kind of a jerk. And I actually feel really bad for kids growing up now who have the words for these things in a way. So I do get a lot of emails from young Black people who are wanting to go into the field of ocean conservation and are saying like, I don't feel comfortable being an only. I can't deal with all these microaggressions in the lab, in grad school. And I'm just like, that's the way the world works. And the expectation that it would be otherwise, like, I guess I feel it's ridiculous that my expectations are that low. But I'm just like, of course there's not a whole bunch of other Black people in your marine biology PhD program. Like, what did you expect? And of course people don't know how to deal with that because they just haven't ever had to before. And so I get that it's really challenging, but like, I'm not very sensitive to that stuff. I will notice it and decide whether it's someone that I want to continue working with. I'm not a masochist, but, I don't hold on to that stuff. Yeah. Some of the best advice my parents ever gave me, my dad was like, choose your battles. And I will battle, but like not every day, not every little thing. And so the most recent time that someone was like, are you supposed to be here? I was at the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado, and they had a conference on climate. And I was there to facilitate a session with Dr. Catherine Wilkinson. about climate solutions and which ones we should be investing the most money in accelerating the implementation of. And after that session, I went into the large hall where they were having some of the keynote speeches. And I'd been sitting so much that day, I didn't want to sit. So I stood in the back. And these security guards were like, please take a seat, ma'am. And I was like, no, I'm just going to stand. That's okay. And that clearly was not an acceptable answer. They were like, we need you to take a seat. And I was like, no, thank you. And they kept just like looking at me out of the corner of their eye super suspiciously. And then like the radios come out. And then they were like, are you supposed to be here? And some white woman next to me was like, she's a speaker. And like, I was wearing the wristband that was like the VIP wristband. And they still were just like, you know, I was wearing the right clothes. I had the right credentials that were visible. I just wasn't obeying the command to sit. And that made me suspicious. And I tweeted about it. And like, the whole thing went bananas. And everyone from the Aspen suit wanted to debrief with me. And I was just like, train your goons to know which bracelet means you're supposed to be there. And we won't, I don't need to like debrief about this with you. Like, there's nothing more to say. Your people screwed up. And they're like, oh, we heard there was, they played the, like, we heard there was a black person on campus who wasn't supposed to be here. So we decided it was you. Which, you know, there aren't that many black people in Aspen, so their odds were probably pretty good if that was indeed happening. And then later that night at the cocktail party, someone was like, you were so good last night. And I was like, what are you talking about? They're like, in the show, you're such a good singer. And I was like, I literally looked at this dude and I was like, different black girl. And he was like, totally different hair, totally different level of melanin. And I was just like, you guys, I'm actually the expert, not the entertainment. Not that there's anything wrong with being an entertainer, but like, but just the fact that at every conference where I'm invited to speak, to be mistaken for the wait staff or an entertainer, because those are the categories in which they can imagine someone who looks like me fitting. But honestly, it doesn't happen that much. And I've just been so lucky to be able to choose my colleagues in the last 5 years in particular. And I've honestly, in the last few weeks, I have learned that I have chosen incredibly well. I haven't had to deal with like any of this nonsense of like, can't you just get back to work? And like, I haven't had any of that. I've had just people picking up the slack for me. I've had, you know, people, you know, trying to figure out how this should change the way we do our work in a meaningful way. I haven't had a lot of sort of, let's just get on with it.
Yeah.
Which would be a real bummer.
And would get that other side. That they
it's don't. Dr. Johnson to you, buddy. If you don't think Black Lives Matter, Dr. Johnson. Them's the rules.
Them's rules. I just remembered that we both are WSL Pure ambassadors.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I think I tweeted, we had not yet met in any way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. but we were in a thing together. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in the same thing with Dr. Elizabeth Johnson.
Stop, like, seriously, stop thinking that I'm cool because, like, I just can't keep up this ruse.
No, you are so much cooler than I'm ever going to be. When I told people that you were coming on, that you were going to be on the show with me, they were like, no. Like, you just started your podcast. I'm like, I know. She said, yes. And I hit her up and like,
I try to say yes to black people as much as I can.
I hit her up in the most rudimentary of ways. And I didn't even like hella rudimentary of ways. DM.
Oh, like on Instagram.
Yeah, I slid into your DMs and was like, hey, Dr. Johnson.
Yeah.
I was just wondering maybe if you want to come on the show.
Like, and you changed your name. Good call. I'm into
it. Yeah. And you were like, yeah, cool. And I didn't even mention that we have the same agent.
That we have the same...
We have the same agent at CA, which I found out.
Wait, randomly. Which agent?
Carly.
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 Okay, I've done the least work with Carly because I don't really do, I don't do TV.
Yet.
I don't really like being on camera.
Do people ask you to do TV? I'm sure that they've pitched you a million different shows of what Elizabeth Johnson Ocean
They
show
mostly
looks
want
like.
Me to be like super science-y, which I would have to just study up for because that's like not my core thing at the moment. Like ocean exploration stuff or that kind of thing.
If we ever get to travel again and the show premise was like, hey, we just want you to go and swim around all of the great oceans and tell stories.
I'd be like, some of the oceans are cold, so can we just stick to the tropics? Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of cold water. That's why I studied coral reefs. It's like Caribbean. Can do Caribbean. They're
not a fan of the wetsuit and booties.
No. I don't even like my face getting hit with cold water. I mean, yeah, I'm kind of a wuss. I'm kind of a wuss.
I'm a South African Haitian who enjoys being cold. I know. My father used to say the same thing.
Unicorn.
He'd be like, you know, I wonder if maybe it's because we have that bit of Scottish in us. Like you have the Scottish recessive genes of your great-grandfather that allow
maybe
you to go
so.
And play in the snow and want to be cold in the ocean. I'm thinking
I do like to go out, and I mean, I love skiing. I like to be outside and like,
you like to hike
in the winter.
You like
yeah,
to
I like
hike
to
fjords.
Hike. I like fjords. Scandinavia, every time I go, I'm like, I'm never coming back. But I, you know, you're like properly outfitted and you're not wet. Like cold water is the thing. Cold air is fine.
But then the
water.
Efficiency of neoprene, especially Japanese rubber, in 2020 is it's incredible. I surf in the winter in days when the water's in the low 50s and I can surf for hours.
You're tougher than I am.
I've just been doing it for a while.
It's okay to be tougher than me about cold water. Like,
okay, guess what? I'm tougher than the good doctor when it comes to cold. Have you ever surfed?
I have.
Yes. How was the experience?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I had a surfboard in my office when I was at Scripps in San Diego.
In La Jolla.
In La Jolla. I was just a few hundred meters from the pier there. I surfed a few times, but I like really bit it when I was first learning. And like I went down and the board went up and it snapped like all the way back at me.
Like a wink.
Just like a boomerang. And yeah. It hit me on the hardest part of my body, my hip bone. And it hurt so bad. And I was like, be tough, like paddle back out. You got this. And I get out there past the break and I was like, I feel like I should listen to my body. So I went back in, I took off my wetsuit and I had like a huge welt already. The skin was broken. It was already bruised.
Like a hematoma.
It was not good. And the surfboard had like a fist size dent in the side. It was a brand new custom Tim Bissell surfboard that I had got. It was teal with turquoise with a red like pen line or whatever. I don't know all the words. It was beautiful.
Legendary surfboard shaper Tim Bissell.
Huge fist size dent along
the
rail.
You know what we call the dents?
What?
A ding.
Dings, yes, dings. Yeah. But this was so big, it was just like, it looked like a shark attacked the surfboard. And I had my scientific scuba diving class the next day, my like final test to be certified as a science diver. And I was kind of a wuss about cold water in San Diego below the thermocline. It can get quite chilly and like I didn't want to go. And like the night dive is like extra cold and you come out. And so I'd been like kind of wussing about the whole thing. And the dive safety officer, I walked into his office. I'm like, I can't dive tomorrow. I'm really hurt. You know, I just went surfing and didn't go so well. And he was like, he rolled his eyes at me. And I was like, fine, I'll be there. And I show up and I do the dive and like everything's fine. And I, you know, check off all the whatever tests. And then I come back up and I peel off my wetsuit and I've got like it stuffed with hiking socks to pad my hip bone from the weight belt, and they fall out of my wetsuit, and then you can see this like terrible bruise. And he was like, "Oh, you weren't lying this time."
Like, I thought you were just trying to normal out of this, but you actually had a legit injury. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for your time.
There's so many things I want to tell you and ask you, but
we can do it again sometime.
This can be the start of a beautiful friendship.
I believe that we could definitely be friends in real life, for sure.
That's like the nicest thing anyone has said to me today.
Really?
Yeah, totally. Friendship. That's like the big time. Although people don't use the word acquaintance as much as they probably should, so.
True. But I'm being honest.
Who knows what you mean by that word?
I'm being honest that we could be friends.
Okay. I'm in. Let's do it.
For sure. Thank you. This has been as cool as something could be, and I will just end it by saying I am an incredible admirer of your work. You're humble to a fault about what you've done and what you're doing, but you have you've opened the door, and you're holding the door open for a whole slew of people to be able to chase dreams and believe that there is no box.
I'm dragging them in. I'm not just leaving the door open. I'm like come on, you guys,
you're in here.
Let's do this.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Conserve your energy and your soul power through this time.
Yeah, this is a lifetime worth of work.
Yeah, to be continued.
To be continued.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Salema.
Bye, Ayana.
It takes a village to bring you the What Shapes Us podcast. Our incredible graphic design team at Parsons Branding. Music by the one and only Hugh Masekela and my band, Alakazam. It is edited by Ernesto Hurtado and Will Broughton. Produced by yours truly, Salema Mabena Masekela. And directed by Ernesto Hurtado, a.k.a. Machete, and myself, Salema Masekela. The What Shapes Us podcast is a Rebel Talk Network production. You're a rat in the race. That's all you can give, but ain't all that it takes. Put your money on the wall, but it won't buy taste. Surprise to catch shine when you stop to embrace. We don't want to watch you go under. Fly, don't want to see you burn. Please, they're going to take your thunder. Why you want to miss your turn? Easy, don't paint by numbers. Fortune only favors the bold. Sweat, no money, no motion. Plant these trees of coffee and gold. Vagabond.